Was gone. We were gone last week, so we didn't do this, but we're back. This is the third week. We've been going about this little exercise. You know, if this is pretty much graduate studies type material. I've told you before that one of the things that the Greek and Hebrew crowd count on is that you are intimidated by anything Greek and Hebrew, anybody that has, you know, any ability to speak or write it or interpret it or read it, or anybody who is comfortable with reference materials that allow them to access it. They just know that for the most part, the average dude, you know, in the pew is not going to mess with it, okay? And I want to assure you that it's just not that hard. It may impress you that I had 3 Greek years of Greek and a year of Hebrew. Don't be impressed. I forgot it all. I'm serious. Okay? Brother, I mean, you know, I can remember a few Spanish words from my youth, but I wouldn't have a chance of understanding what some Spanish guy's saying. Because, you know, if you don't use it, it fades on you, you know. I tell you what I can do, though. I can use reference materials. And you know what? You could too. It's just not that tough. But we're talking about this thing you hear all the time that, you know, one of the implicit heresies of quote-unquote Ruckmanism is this, and the King James only position is that he believes that the Greek is superior to Greek and Hebrew. The English, did I say? The English is superior to Greek and Hebrew. The King James Bible can actually show you something that you couldn't get if you were a master of Greek and Hebrew. I just want you to know that is an eye-rolling, ridiculous thing to the folks at Central Seminary. And I'm here to say that to me it's an eye-rolling, ridiculous thing. If you go, I was just, you know, Vlad sent me something via email this last week, and the agape phileo thing. I mean, this is a modern author. It's not like they've figured it out yet. I mean, he goes into, you know, John 21, agape phileo, and that's not what Jesus really said, because in the Greek it's something deeper, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know. And off he went, and, you know, he never, if there's some things that are obvious, that guy never looked at how the rest of the Bible uses agape phileo. Never bothered. And so he just passes it on to a bunch of suckers who now think they don't have a Bible that's perfect. And, you know, they're too intimidated by the reference materials. And look, you can do this with a Strong's Concordance, okay? And if you have, well, I'm assuming you could learn to use, you know, any Bible program. But if you have my Bible program, I can show you how to use it real fast. And computer program. And, you know, you can run all the references. There's some eyesight that you burn up and some stuff like that. But it's just not, you know, it's not that hard. If you can use a concordance, you can do this. You say, but I don't know Greek and Hebrew. It doesn't matter. You can do it by the numbers. I'm serious. Now, so we've been talking about this, and we've covered several things. And all I'm trying to show, I'm not trying to be contrary. I have pastor friends that probably don't take this position or anything. But I'm trying to show you that, you know, you don't have to duck your head when some people say some things that they say these days, much less do you have to be intimidated by somebody that knows Greek. You know, there's this fellow Ziadates, and he's a you know, native Greek. And so, you know, he's the greatest commentator in the world because, you know, he knows the Greek. And by heart he knows it. Doesn't mean anything. It means zero. It means absolutely nothing. After all, could all of you teach English grammar? Well, I know better than that. Would all of you consider yourselves authorities to be able to? I mean, aren't you a native English speaker? Well, some of you are uncomfortable with teaching an English Bible. Okay, so learn better. But just because somebody's a, you know, Greek or Hebrew and knows that stuff, and because they've sat in an office and studied, you know, and have 2 or 3 doctorates in languages, doesn't mean that they have authority over you. It does not mean that's the case. Now, we've talked about several things here. I'm trying to give you examples, and I'm trying to show you that this is not, Brother Stevens has just found 2 or 3 exceptions that we can hang our hat on and go forward and, you know, just say and continue in our delusion that the King James Bible is something really special. It's not like that. I mean, it's there are, I don't know how many there are. I'm still reading and finding them. I'm telling you this, I'm finding new ones every week. Well, you know, when I'm paying attention, taking care, and, you know, running the references with, you know, computer program and stuff, and I'm finding stuff every week. And all it takes is just a little bit of watch care as you know, reading and so on and so forth. So, you know, I keep finding new stuff. We talked about the vestment thing. Remember that? Talked about the synagogue thing. We went over last week the agape phileo thing. And then we went over the charity thing. All those new Bibles want to change charity to love. Don't do that. Don't do that. We talked about, what else? The himself thing, God shall provide for himself a lamb. Now, you know, not only does that show you that the English contains something that the Hebrew doesn't, all the new Bibles say, and you would get this from Hebrew, that God will provide for himself a lamb, but the King James Bible says God will provide himself a lamb. By the way, that's not only something that you wouldn't get, you know, in Hebrew, but you got in English. That is also another heresy, advanced revelation, because it actually is a prophecy not contained in Hebrew that God will one day provide himself a lamb. See what I'm saying? All right, we talked about that. We talked about the whole science thing. The only time in the Bible that gnosko is used science is in 1 Timothy. And we talked about that, how the fact is, you know, knowledge is not the issue. Science is the issue, and so on, right? So we wanted to go on here. I don't know how many more weeks this will go. I can easily go another couple weeks. It'll depend on if you guys want to go another couple of weeks with this. But let us turn to Romans chapter 16. We've talked about this before, and I'm not going to take a lot of time with it because hopefully once we get into it, you'll remember it. But I wanted to show you how playing the Greek game. I was just talking to somebody here this last week. They just had meetings at their church. This is a basketball family, and they're fine folks, all right? I like them. They like me. Hey, that's unusual. And, you know, one of the things that they said was, oh, we had good meetings. You know, the guy came in, and basically he taught instead of you know, more evangelistic revival. It's more teaching. And he taught, you know, Psalm 119. He said, you know, he went to the Hebrew, and it was really good. So, you know, all week they listen to somebody go to the Hebrew, okay? There's a real danger in that, and sometimes people think they're getting something they're not getting. Now, I'll give you a perfect example. In Romans chapter 16, and not to belabor this too deeply because we've talked about it in a slightly different context a couple other occasions. Look in Romans chapter 16, verse 1. It's an innocent, terribly innocent-looking verse in English. I commend unto you Phoebe, our sister, which is a servant of the church, which is at Cenchrea. Okay? No problem there, right? Except one day a Greek head was reading through the Bible, and he got to the Greek Bible, and he got to Romans 16 and found that the word for servant in 16:1 is the Greek form of the word deacon. Diakonos, deacon. And therefore, what has pervaded ever since whoever this dweeb was started it, probably a long, long time ago, ever since that time we've had to fight off this idea of women being deacons. There are lots of Baptist churches that not only have women pastors, but women deacons these days. Okay, you'll hear it all the time. If you listen to Christian radio much, you'll hear somebody make comment and make mention that, you know, one of the things you get from the Greek that you don't get from the English is that Phoebe was a deaconess. Okay? All right, now what are you going to do? Well, I tell you what, folks, that if you're intimidated by Greek and Hebrew, in this case Greek, then you're not going to do nothing. You're going to let the guy talk, and you're going to either take the position, well, both Stephen said and Dr. Ruckman says that it doesn't matter, so I'm just going to believe them, or else you're going to believe him. And then where are you? You just believe me or you just believed him. That's not the issue. That's not the issue at all. That's not what I'm after. I got news for you. That's not what Doc's after either. Okay? Now, what are you going to do with this thing? Well, I'll tell you, you know, one of the things that you can start with is, like I said, if you have the reference materials, you don't have to be a Greek kook or anything like that. You know, an odd thing is when you press a few buttons on a computer, you can find out how many times this word occurs in the New Testament. And you know, you find an interesting thing. Turn your Bibles to a few places. I'm not going to make a long process out of this morning, but in Matthew chapter 22, let's just start there for just a minute. Matthew 22. And you understand, if we're going to play this game, if we're going to make Phoebe a deaconess, then we're going to translate diakonos as a deacon every time. Let's be consistent, shall we? All right, Matthew chapter 22, notice verse 13. Then said the king to the servants, bind him hand and foot and take him away and cast him into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. In verse 13, you know what the word for servants is? Deacon. Diakonos. So let's read it that way. Then said the king to the deacons, bind him hand and foot. Now, Brother Steve would go for that, I know. I don't know if Dave would or not, but bind him hand and foot. I mean, really, folks, come on. Look at another one nearby here. Look at 23:11. 23:11. Our deacons would like this too. But he that is greatest among you shall be your deacon. It's a Greek word for deacon there. Again, it's diakonos. So here's something plain. And the King James translators, and by the way, also, the New Version translators, sometimes translated diakonos as deacon. Sometimes they translated it as servants. I'll show you one that should tie the rag on the bush for you. I have 12 or 14 listed here that we could show the same thing. I'm not trying to beat you to death with this, especially since we've seen it in a little bit different context before. But look in Galatians chapter 2, all right? Galatians chapter 2, verse 17. I guarantee you that there's not an Alexandrian Bible teacher around that's going to advocate translating it like this. But what they count on is that you not knowing these things, so you don't go check to see that Phoebe should have been translated servant like she was translated as servant. In Galatians chapter 2, verse 17, but if while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves also are found sinners, is therefore Christ the minister of sin? God forbid. The word for minister there, guess what word it is in Greek? Translate it. Go ahead, read it like that. Is Christ therefore the deacon of sin? You can't do that. Now, you know, here's my point. Okay, you know the word deacon in English, even though out of Greek, it's either translated, that Greek word is either translated servant, minister, or deacon in a King James Bible, okay? In the King James Bible, one of the things that you see is the deacons are only translated, I mean, diakonos is only translated deacons in reference to the office of deacon in a local church, okay? I mean, it delineated it. I'm forgetting right now where those are, but 1 Timothy and Titus, right? Four or five times, deacon, it's specifically the office of a deacon. The rest of the time, diakonos is translated either servant or minister because, folks, deacon won't work there. But the King James translators did something wonderful for you. If you were just a Greek speaker with just a Greek Bible, you would have to make decisions about how you understood this deacon thing. Is Phoebe a deaconess? Was Christ the deacon of sin? Are these servants, you know, are the deacons casting people into hell? You understand? The King James translators, and I say God through the Holy Spirit, made some basic delineations for you so that in your language, those concepts are delineated separately so you never even have to worry about them. I mean, all you have to do is go say, okay, there's New Testament deacons, that's an office in a local church, and those are delineated by, you know, the King James translators. And whereas if you go to Greek, you know, you wind up confused because you've got to now make a decision that they made. Are you more qualified to make Greek decisions than the King James translators? I hope you say no. if you don't say no, we're going to tie you up and stick your head in a toilet, because you're an idiot compared to those people. I'll tell you that right now. I'm talking about a moral level, but it goes deeper than that. Is God willing to use you to delineate out of the Greek into English more than he was willing to use those men? And again, I hope that you don't say, yes, he's willing to use me more. That would be a mistake. Brother Paul? That very thing. Absolutely. And, you know, what you ought to understand is that people are looking for, you know, folks that are motives behind some of this stuff. There are folks that are trying to tear down barriers and tear down walls so that anything is acceptable in a local church. And if they can justify, you know, not having to draw a line on, sorry ladies, draw a line on women for leadership, they're going to do everything that they can to avoid it. They really are. All right. Now, that's one. That's a New Testament snag. You hear that stuff all the time. Paul just says, if you listen to Christian radio, you'll hear that. If you read devotional material, if you go down to and shop at Northwestern, you're going to be able to find material on that all the time. Let me show you another New Testament snag. I don't want you to think that this is just arcane and unimportant. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and there's a better way to do this. It'd be better if we were in a classroom setting, and it would be also better if I were a handout type of guy. So I got all this stuff together and handed out handouts to you, but I figure you'd throw away the handout, so I don't want to waste trees. Anyway, so this would be easier looking at if you are really interested and really want, we went through this in Institute, but if you really want, you know, a handout, I'll be able to provide it for you, okay? But in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, there's a little bit of a flap here. You ever been to a church where the ladies wore head coverings? Little doilies on their head, or maybe bonnets or whatever, you know. And this is the passage where they come to. Mennonites are sometimes, or often folks that do that. The Amish often do. We've had folks that came here looking for a church that weren't Amish or Mennonite, but hubby was a Greek head, and the Greek head decided his wife needed to wear a covering when she prayed in church. So when we bowed our head to pray, she'd put a doily on her head. I don't know what that doily is supposed to do, folks, but I'm talking about a little, you know, just a little doily-looking thing, put it on her head. And while we prayed, she was covered, and that was okay, and then she'd take it off when we weren't. So, okay? Why? Well, once again, the answer comes not from reading King James Bible at all. For instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 4, some of this is hard to take in our modern society, because of, again, the woman-man relation and so on. But in verse 4, every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonoreth his head. Now, we're talking about this covering here. All right, verse 5, every woman that prayeth or prophesieth with her head uncovered, dishonoreth her head. Now, in the end, what's proven here is that Christ is the head of the man, and the man in leadership is head of the woman. And so a man's covering, Christ, is honorable. So a man should not cover his head. A woman's covering is just a mortal man, her husband. And therefore, she does cover her head. It's a leadership thing. It's an authority thing. It's symbolic, okay, of some things. Go on down, though, and I'm not going to get into the deep doctrine of it, because I don't know if it is that deep. But verse 6, for if the woman be not covered also, let her also be shorn, and if it be a shame for a woman to be shorn or shaven, let her be covered. For a man indeed ought not be to cover his head. So cover, 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 right? Verse 13, judging yourselves, is it comely that a woman pray unto God uncovered? Right? So far so good. Now watch. If there's any doubt about it, look in verse 15. But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. I'm not going to talk about long hair and short hair and all that this morning for the sake of time. But is it not plain by the time you get to the end of the passage, if you were confused about what should happen in verse 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, is it or is it not cleared up by verse 15? Ladies, are you covered when you pray? If you have long hair, you're covered. Literally. You're covered. Right? Is that plain or not? Ladies, do you need a doily on your head? Do you need a bonnet to pray? If you have long hair. If you're not careful, I'm going to ask the teenagers in a second now. You don't want that. Do you need, if you're cut, if you got long hair, ladies, do you need a hat to pray? No. Why? Because it says the hair is given her for a covering, right? Now, here's the gig. The word for the covering in 1 Corinthians is, let me see if I can do this, katalupto, or a form thereof, all right? So, here's this Greek kid reading along, and the King James Bible is perfectly clear, okay? And all the way through 1 Corinthians chapter 11, katalupto, on the covering, until you get to verse 15. And in verse 15, the Greek is a different Greek word. So what does this mean to a Greek head? A Greek head goes, oh, the verse in English that settles that the woman's hair is given her for a covering, that covering in verse 15 is a different covering. Therefore, the woman does need a covering on her head to pray because it used a different Greek word. And since I'm a Greek head and I found something different in Greek than I have in English, that just proves that you get something more from Greek than you do English. You know what that proves? That proves that there are synonyms in Greek just like there are in English. And just like phileo and agape are synonyms in Greek for love, and in the New Testament, English, it's just love. Okay? Just like there are synonyms for words in English, there are synonyms for words in Greek. And guess what? God knows what those words are. And He interchanges synonyms all the time. But to clear up the matter so that somebody reading Greek wouldn't be confused, you get to the King James Bible. Could you explain to me why the Lord would go through all this covering, uncovering explanation only to change gears completely in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 15? You understand what I'm talking about? I know you don't have it right before the Greek stuff and all right before your eyes, but every single one of those coverings is one word, and then you get to the last one, and it's a different Greek word. The Greek heads draw from that, therefore, that a woman does need a covering when she prays. And so they got a doily, the Amish and the Mennonites, and Greek head New Testament Christians have doilies on their head when their women pray. But you see, why are you confused? You're confused because you went to Greek. Because it's perfectly plain in English. Are you not better off in English than having to make discernments that you're not qualified to make as an English speaker in Greek? Why should you put your expertise in Greek up against the expertise of the King James translators? But more importantly, since you're going to trust what some dweeb on WCTS says, you're going to either trust what he says about Greek and about this passage, or you're going to trust what God put in your King James Bible. You're going to wind up trusting somebody somewhere along the way. I got news for you. The new versions do not translate all words consistently either. Either God had a hand in it, or we are all afloat. What you have in a King James Bible is superior to the Greek in this case because it's plain. It's consistent from top to bottom. And verse 15 is what ties the rag on the bush. Oh, okay, that settles it. Whereas if you go there in Greek, that doesn't settle anything. Are you with me? See what I'm saying? Any questions or comments so far? Okay, let me give you another example or two. Let me decide which one to do here. Let's go back to Psalms. I gotta find it here. I'm sifting through my some new stuff along with the Institute stuff, but Psalm chapter 8, I believe. Okay, Psalm 8 and then Hebrews 2. Psalms 8. Hebrews chapter 2. All right. Psalms 8, verse 5. Psalms 8, 5. For thou hast made him, who? Christ. For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels. Well, actually, it's talking about man, but you'll see later that it's a reference to Christ. Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels and hast crowned him with glory and honor. No problem, right? Okay, keep your finger in Psalm 8, but look at Hebrews chapter 2, where in verse 7, this time definitively talking about Christ and man as well. Verse 7, thou madest him a little lower than the angels, thou crownest him with glory and honor, didst set him over the work of thy hands. And then verse 9, that was talking about man. Now verse 9, but we see Jesus who was made a little lower than the angels. Okay, concentrate on little lower than the angels, little lower than the angels. Twice in Hebrews 2, once in Psalms 8, right? Okay, Psalms 8, look at that one. Psalm 8, and notice verse 5. Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels. That is an utterly and entirely unique verse in the Old Testament, when we're playing this Greek and Hebrew game. Because the word for angels is Elohim. Now, if you listen to Christian radio and if you read devotional material, you probably have a clue here. Elohim is the Old Testament, one of the Old Testament words for God, right? And just so you know, folks in the Old Testament, and I didn't count every one of them. I mean, I was punching a button. You know, I know roughly how many verses are on a page, you know, on computer. But that word in Hebrew shows up 2,600 times in the Old Testament. 2,600 times. That's a lot. Okay. Psalms chapter 8, verse 5 is unique in its translation of Elohim. Nowhere else in the Bible is Elohim translated angels. Nowhere. Mostly, it's translated God. Mostly. There are some occasions where it is translated gods, small g gods. In a few occasions, it's translated judges. And in some occasions, it's translated goddess. Okay? Okay, now listen, folks. Just forget that you know the New Testament. Forget it. You're a Hebrew Jewish scholar. And you have before you here the knowledge that Elohim is God more than anything else. And you come to Psalm 8:5. Why in the name of heaven would you translate it angels? You understand what I'm saying? One time in 2,600 times, that Hebrew word is translated angels. And it's Psalm 8:5. Why would you do that? What would lead to your decision to do that? Well, if you did know the New Testament, you would probably recognize that Hebrews 2, 7, and 9 quoted Psalm 8, 5. And so if you did that, you could back read it in. You could do that. But if Greek and Hebrew is such the treasure as they say it is, And if Greek and Hebrew is the final authority, I got news for you. There is not a new, there, well, I can't say that. The new versions do not translate it angels. They translate it either God, they made him a little lower than God, or gods. They translate it different. All the new versions, I'm not saying every single one, I didn't check every single one. Every one that I had access to changes it. Hebrews 8:5 does not read in new versions like it reads in there. Okay? Now, but I'll get you in just a second, Chris, but let me make a couple points here first. Does anybody have any qualms with the way it was translated since Hebrews 2, 7, and 9 are translated that way? How are you benefited by going to the Hebrew? You're not benefited. You're confused. Because suddenly you go in here and you're just a Hebrew head now, and all you can see is, oh my goodness, 2,600 times, and most of those 2,600 times, it's translated God. It's translated God, and oh my goodness, here's this one time that it's translated angel. There is no way angel's the right thing there. This is not a unique verse. Do you understand the confusion if you're just playing with the Hebrew? Chris. Right? And so is man. And it applies to both. It applied to Hebrews 2, it applies to man, and then he extends it to Jesus Christ in Hebrews 2:9. All right, here's the thing. The King James translators made a decision that, first of all, you would be unqualified to make. Right? First of all, academically, you are not, and you don't know anybody that has the scholarship to compare with the King James translators. That's just the mortal part. That's just the purely scholastic academic part. You also, I don't believe that God's going to lead you like he led that company of translators. My question for you is, how in this verse are you not benefited by the English more than if you were a native speaker of Hebrew? Folks, you know what the native speakers of Hebrews think? The native speakers of Hebrew think that Jesus Christ was an imposter. They killed him. And they're looking for him to still come the first time. They have lost 2,000 years of history. Native speakers of Hebrew. If all of the treasures were found in Hebrew, why aren't the Jews saved? If all the treasures were found in Greek, how come we don't get our best Bible believers from Greece? Right? I mean, if they have treasures in their native language that, you know, none of us are, you know, have access to because none of us know Greek like that, then why don't we get our very best Bible believers and preachers from Greece? Folks, you don't, because it's not in Greek and Hebrew, in spite of the fact that that was what the Bible was written in originally. It's in God's power, not only inspiring Scripture, but preserving Scripture. And being in the process of the translation of Scripture. Again, my question is, how is it that your English Bible is not superior to the Hebrew? In that. It is. It is. Questions or comments? Bryce. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Brother Dave. It is, yes. They It is a dead language, and yeah. There, I mean, it would be even beyond. I mean, we think of our English, and then there's Shakespearean English, and it would be even past that. But still, I mean, there's enough similarities that, you know, if Greek was the treasure, you know, why wouldn't they be producing the greatest Bible believers in the world? Steve. Oh, it's not. No. There are authors that say that the English is a transparent to the Hebrew and the Greek. That if there is a language that reflects Greek, and you hear the exact opposite from, you know, the basic Bible scholar. But that the English actually reflects with great clarity and tone and all those things and inflection Greek and Hebrew. So, you know, a lot of it is, folks, look, people throw smoke and mirrors at you all the time. I mean, these politicians, I mean, you get smoke and mirror. You can't believe what anybody says that calls you up trying to sell you something. And you know that. My question for you is, do the same telemarketers are of the same flesh as Bible scholars. Bible scholars have the same flesh as politicians. And you just can't believe them just because they say something's true and then say, and I can say this, you know, authoritatively because I know something you don't know, in particular Greek and Hebrew. That does not cut it. That's not what your faith is built on. Paul. Yep. Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Let me. Somebody else have a hand up? Okay. Let me. I want you to know that this is not, you know, Brother Stevens has a half dozen thing, you know, and they prove his point, so he can, you know, elaborate on those. No, it's not like that. It's not like that at all. I'm still discovering more. Let me take you over to a place here that I don't know where it's at yet. All right. Turn in your Bible. So what's am I going to cover here? Let me just give you a verse, all right? Look in Hebrews 7. This has major doctrinal imports, major doctrinal imports. It's very widespread. This is not a singular case. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 22. If anybody wants a little instruction on how I, you know, the use of reference materials, we did this some in Institute. If anybody here is interested in, you know, having me show you, you know, how I'm accessing this kind of stuff, this is not the work of a big brain. All right, I'll be happy to show you. You may have to. You know, I can show you best with my computer program that I have on my computer at home or a laptop that I have. And that's the one I use. I'm assuming you can probably do it with others. But Hebrews chapter 7, verse 22. By so much was Jesus made a surety of a better testament. Okay, just for reference, though, I wanted you to see Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 7. For if that first covenant had been faultless, look in verse 8, middle of the verse, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. Okay, I wanted to show you that there's, in the New Testament, in your English, you have two English words. One of those words is covenant. And one of those words is testament. The tendency in the new versions, almost all of them, by the way, I think maybe all of them, the tendency in the new versions is to not have a New Testament. It's New Covenant. Anytime you read in your New Testament, the new versions will shift it to covenant. Both those words come from diathekes. I'm not sure if I'm transliterating that like I should, but diathekes, whatever. Word shows up like between 35 and 40 times in the New Testament. Again, in English, sometimes it's translated testament. In King James English, sometimes it's translated testament. Sometimes it's translated covenant. In the New Versions, it is almost universally translated covenant. Okay? How many of you have listened to Christian radio and it's declared to you as a matter of fact that you're under the New Covenant? The only one so far. Maybe I've run you all off and you're not listening to Christian radio anymore. I'm not sure that that's bad. But you've read it. You read it in devotional material, whatever. New Covenant, right? I just want you to know something. You're not under the New Covenant. You're not. You say, prove it. Okay. Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 7. For if that first covenant, talking about the Old Testament law, correct, had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second. For finding fault with them, he saith, Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with who? The house of Israel and the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant. And I regarded them not, saith the Lord. Now this covenant, again, is the same word. For this is the covenant, so here's the covenant he's going to make with them in those days, that I will make with the house of Israel after those days. After what days? Right. Prophetically, after the second coming. Okay? After the tribulation's over, Jesus Christ comes back, and a new covenant is established with Israel. Here's the nature of it. Middle of verse 10. I will put my laws in their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me from the least to the greatest. Okay, let me ask you a question. Is that the covenant that you're under? No. I mean, first of all, if you have the law of God in your mind, it's because you've memorized it. It's not because He put it there. He's not given you a new heart completely, which is verified by some of the thoughts that you've had this very morning. Right? And even more importantly, they shall not teach every man his neighbor. Doesn't look like a good Calvinistic thing, huh? I mean, are you not under the New Testament where go ye therefore and teach all nations? I mean, are you not supposed to be a neighbor to somebody that's lost? Are you not supposed to teach? Are not women, older women in church, for instance, supposed to teach the younger women how to love their husband? Yes, you are. Okay, so what's the point, Brother Stevens? I'm telling you that if you will go study your English Bible, you will learn that the covenant, that one word, translated covenant in the New Testament, points to that covenant with Israel. Okay? And the Testament is more general and applies to you and me. We are in the New Testament, but the New Covenant does not apply to us. Folks, and we're going to have perfect bodies by the time the New Testament comes. We're not going to need a law. We're going to be like Christ. So, once again, now remember, 40 times, diathekes, you're reading the Greek New Testament. You don't know English. You don't know German. You don't know nothing but Greek. You read diathekes, and having read that, you have to, why would you translate it more than one way? Testament or covenant, one or the other? I understand why the New Bible Version people translated it as one. They say, what in the world is the difference? You know, why would you translate it two different ways? So they just lump it all together. Well, the important thing to take note of there is that we're supposed to rightly divide the word of truth. Apparently, the English is the word of truth, and apparently you would have an easier division of it in English because the word, the concepts are delineated. There's a difference between a covenant and a testament. And the Lord didn't make the mistake of making the New Testament equal with the New Covenant, because they're not equal. And you have it in English. And if you just have Greek, you don't have it. You don't have it. So tell me, why is the Greek better than the English? You have something perfectly clarified before your eyes so that you don't even have to wrestle with the language. All you have to do is read what you already know and understand it to rightly divide it. See, here's the deal. Here's the really disturbing part. I couldn't walk into Podunk Baptist Church and teach this stuff because they don't even know there's a difference between the New Testament and the New Covenant. You know, they would look at me like only four or five of you were looking at me this morning. Like, what is he talking about? Because they've had no exercise in believing the English Bible to start with. They've not rightly divided the English Bible to start with. And so when you start talking about covenant testament, what's the difference? They don't even get it. You understand? Maybe you don't. Paul? In general, I mean, when you look at it, you look it up on the, you know, in a concordance. Basically, you know, Testament is a broader term, okay? And for instance, a testament is not of effect until after the testator is dead. Well, folks, that's the case with both the New Testament in His blood, which is our testament where, I mean, Christ had to be dead before the New Testament took effect. You understand that? But He also had to be dead before the New Covenant takes effect, too. So it's broader. It's more inclusive. New Testament is more inclusive. If anything, the New Covenant is much more fine and much more delineated, and that's the point. Okay? Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, you can look at me, but this is the New Testament in my blood. Here's Christ. Has the cup. This is the New Testament in my blood. It represents the blood of Christ. Okay? Now, this is the New Covenant in my blood. Well, all of a sudden, I'm left out. Because I'm not a partaker of the New Covenant. I never partake of the New Covenant. I'm the bride of Christ. I'm part of the body of Christ. And when the New Covenant is established up in the millennium, it's Israel. It's all Israel. Right? So if He had said, this is the New Covenant, which the New Versions say, this is the New Covenant in my blood, it would be untrue for me and you. We get left out. So He didn't make that mistake. He said, this is the New Testament in my blood. It applies to both Kyle Stevens, and it also applies to Israel in the millennium. It's more inclusive. But there's a doctrinal difference there, and people wonder, you know, why doctrine is now a big bore and why nobody knows any doctrine anymore. Because they can't make judgments. They can't make delineations. Yes, sir? Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. As you're talking, I'm stricken by something I hadn't thought about before. Everybody, yeah, our team plays basketball at Roseville Covenant Church. You're familiar with covenant churches, right? You know what covenant churches teach? They teach that when New Testament people enter a covenant with God, and that covenant is entered by baptism, basically. And there's some variation depending on how liberal they are, but just as Israel in the Old Testament had a covenant, that since we're under the new covenant is baptism, and if you live right, you can go to heaven, as long as you keep the covenant, because then God will keep the covenant with you. That's the basic teaching. Folks, you realize that. These people are practicing covenant theology when they're not under a covenant. They're under a testament. They would have known that if they had believed their English Bible. Yes, sir? Here's another aspect of this thing. Okay. King James translators translate it and say testament and covenant, right? And that this is the Old and New Testaments translated out of the original languages, correct? You do realize that some of those King James translators were basically covenant theologians, don't you? They believed that baptism was some of them were Protestants, and I mean, you know, there was a if they didn't properly call themselves covenant theologians, there was very definitively a string in there, a trail whereby they believed that you entered by a covenant with God in baptism, and if you kept the covenant, He would keep you. Okay, so you say, and my point is, why would people that believed that make a delineation between covenant and testament? Why would they translate it that way? Unless it wasn't them doing it at all. Unless it was God directing them. So here are these some of these King James translators, and they're what? They sprinkle babies. Right? They're Calvinists. They put together a book that is against infant baptism and against Calvinism. So, you know, if they just had, you know, if they just had this corner, if they had this motive, why didn't they translate it in such a way that their prejudices came through? And the fact is, they didn't. And I believe that God used them. I'm not saying they weren't saved. I think that most of them, if not all of them, were saved. But they weren't perfect in theology. King James wasn't perfect in theology. Doesn't matter. Yes, sir? That's very true. Yep. That's right. Okay, I'll give you one more quickie here before we close, all right? Look in Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23, verse 33. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, there they crucified him. We sing all kinds of Calvary songs, don't we? Years of spending vanity and pride, you know. I mean, Calvary, Calvary, Calvary. How many times do you think Calvary shows up in the King James Bible? One time. How many times do you think Calvary shows up in the New Versions? Zero. Now, in Greek, the word for Calvary is that is used there for Calvary. That is, was the word that they translated Calvary is cranion, cranium. You know, cranium, head, place of the skull, right? Okay, in four places in your King James Bible, once in each New Testament gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, cranion shows up. In one place, it's translated Calvary, verse 33. The rest of them, it's a place of a skull, or Golgotha. Okay? In no translation, new translation, do you find Calvary? Now, all I wanted to point out to you in this is, you know, we sometimes look at the Word of God and, yeah, it's quick and powerful and alive and all those things. And, you know, yeah, it has power and my word shall not return to me void. And yeah, I know that. I want you to think about something. In one English version, there is one verse translated Calvary. And out of that has come all the songs naming Calvary. Do you know how many Calvary Baptist churches there are in this country? You know what I mean? I mean, you sing songs about it. Do you know how many times on Christian radio in America a day the word Calvary is used? In other words, for one translation, one verse, one-time usage of the word Calvary, and we use the word all the time. But it's not that way in Greek, so why don't we just remove it? Then where would you get your Calvary from? You see what I'm saying? The simple point being, you know, you want to play this Greek game, are you sure you want to do that? In fact, does this not testify that the English has so much more power over, you know, over people's minds than the Greek does, that even people who hold a Bible that doesn't have Calvary in it still use the word Calvary all the time? Right.